Suspended from these girders, 15 meters above the ring, was a series of catwalks, once used by the guards to monitor the floor below. These were arranged like the spokes of a wheel, with ducts running above them, wide enough for a person to crawl through. Once they had secured the catwalk, Peter and the others would descend by flights of stairs at the north and south ends of the room. These led to 3 tiers of caged balconies encircling the yard. This would be where most of the crowd would be, Olsen explained, with perhaps 12 stationed on the floor to operate the fire line. The viral, Babcock, would enter through the opening in the roof on the east side of the room. The cattle, 4 head, would be driven in from the opposite end, through a gap in the fire line, followed by the 2 people slated for the sacrifice. 4 and 2, Olsen said, for each new moon. As long as we give him the 4 and 2, he keeps the many away. The many. That was what Olsen called the other virals. The ones of Babcock, he explained. The ones of his blood. He controls them? Peter asked, not really believing any of it yet. It was all too fantastic, though even as he formed the question, he felt his skepticism giving way. If Olsen was telling the truth, a great deal suddenly made sense. The haven itself, its impossible existence, the strange behavior of the residents, like people carrying a terrible secret, even the virals themselves, and the feeling Peter had harbored his whole life that they were more than the sum of their parts. He doesn't just control them, Olsen answered. As he spoke, a heaviness seemed to come over him. It was as if he'd waited years to tell the story. He is them, Peter. I'm sorry I lied to you before, but it couldn't be helped. The first settlers who came here weren't refugees. They were children. The train brought them here, from where exactly we don't know. They were going to hide in Yucca Mountain in the tunnels inside it. But Babcock was already here. That was when the dream began. Some say it's a memory from a time before he became a viral, when he was still a man. But once you've killed the woman in the dream, you belong to him. You belong to the ring. The hotel, with the blocked streets, Hollis ventured. It's a trap, isn't it? Olsen nodded. For many years we sent out patrols to bring in as many more as we could. A few just wandered through. Others were left there by the virals for us to find. Like you, Sarah. Sarah shook her head. I still don't remember what happened. No one ever does. The trauma is simply too great. Olsen looked imploringly at Peter again. You must understand. We've lived this way always. It was our only way to survive. For most, the ring seems a small price to pay. Well, it's a lousy deal if you ask me, Alicia cut in. Her face was hardened with anger. I've heard enough. These people are collaborators. They're like pets. Something darkened in Olsen's expression, though his tone, when he continued, was still almost eerily calm. Call us what you like. You can't say anything I haven't said to myself 1,000 times. Mira was not my only child. I had a son, too. He would be about your age if he had lived. When he was chosen, his mother objected. In the end, Jude sent her into the ring with him. His own son, Peter thought. Olsen had sent his own son to die. Why Jude? Olsen shrugged. It's who he is. There has always been Jude. He shook his head again. I would explain it better if I could. But none of that matters now. What's past is past, or so I tell myself. There's a group of us who've been preparing for this day for years. To get away, to live our lives as people. But unless we kill Babcock, he'll call the many. With these weapons, we have a chance. So who's in the ring? We don't know. Jude wouldn't say. What about Mouse and Amy?
I told you, we don't know where they are.
Peter turned to Elisha. It's them.
We don't know that, Olsen objected. And Mausami is pregnant. Jude wouldn't choose her.
Peter was unconvinced. Even more. Everything Olsen had said made him believe that Maus and Amy were the ones in the ring. Is there another way inside? That was when Olsen explained the layout, the ducts above the catwalks, kneeling on the floor of the garage to draw in the dust.
It will be pitch black for the first part, he warned, as his men were passing out rifles and pistols from the cache taken from the Humvee. Just follow the sound of the crowd.
How many more men do you have inside? Hollis asked. He was filling his pockets with magazines. Kneeling by an open crate, Caleb and Sarah were both loading rifles.
The seven of us, plus another four in the balconies.
That's all, Peter said. The odds, not good to begin with, were suddenly much worse than he'd thought.
How many does Jude have?
Olsen frowned.
I thought you understood. He has all of them.
When Peter said nothing, Olsen continued. Babcock is stronger than any viral you've ever seen, and the crowd won't be on our side.
Killing him won't be easy.
Has anyone ever tried?
Once. He hesitated. A small group, like us. It was many years ago.
Peter was about to ask what had happened, but he heard, in Olsen's silence, the answer to his question.
You should have told us.
A look of abject resignation came into Olsen's face. Peter realized that what he was seeing there was a burden far heavier than sorrow or grief. It was guilt.
Peter, what would you have said?
He didn't answer. He didn't know. Probably he wouldn't have believed him. He wasn't sure what he believed now. But Amy was inside the ring. Of that he was certain. He felt it in his bones. He popped the clip from his pistol to blow it clean, then reinserted it into the handle and pulled the slide. He looked toward Elisha, who nodded. Everyone was ready. We're here to get our friends, he said to Olsen. The rest is up to you. But Olsen shook his head.
Make no mistake. Once you're in the ring, our fights are the same. Babcock has to die. Unless we kill him, he'll call the many. The train will make no difference.
New moon. Babcock felt the hunger uncoiling inside him, and he stretched out his mind from this place, the place of return, saying, It is time. It is time, Jude. Babcock was up. Babcock was flying, soaring over the desert floor in leaps and bounds, the great joyful hunger coursing through him. Bring them to me. Bring me one and then another. Bring them that you should live in this way and no other. There was blood in the air. He could smell it, taste it, feel its essence coursing through him. First would come the blood of the beasts, a living sweetness. And then his best and special, his Jude, who dreamed the dream better than all the others since the time of becoming, whose mind lived with him in the dream like a brother, would bring the ones of blood that Babcock would drink and be filled by it. He mounted the wall in a single jump. I am here. I am Babcock. We are Babcock. He descended. He heard the gasps of the crowd. Around him the fires blazed up. Behind the flames were the men, come to watch and know. And through the gap he saw the beasts approaching, driven on the whip, their eyes fearless and unknowing, and the hunger lifted him up in a wave, and he was sailing down upon them, tearing and ripping, first one and then the other, each in its turn, a glorious fulfillment. We are Babcock. He could hear the voices now, the chant of the crowds in their cages, behind the ring of flames,
and the voice of his one, his Jude, standing on the catwalk above, leading them as if in song. Bring them to me. Bring me one and then another. Bring them that we should live. A wall of sound ascending in fierce unison. In this way and no other. A pair of figures appeared in the gap. They stumbled forward, pushed by men who quickly stepped away. The flames rose again behind them, a door of fire sealing them inside for the taking. The crowd roared. Ring, ring, ring. A stampede of feet, the air shuddering, hammering. Ring, ring, ring. And that was when he felt her. In a bright and terrible burst, Babcock felt her. The shadow behind the shadow, the tear in the fabric of night. The one who carried the seed of forever but was not of his blood, was not of the 12 or the 0. The one called Amy. Peter heard it all from the ventilation shaft. The chanting, the panicked cries of the cattle, and then the silence, of bated breath, of some terrible spectacle about to unfold, and then the explosion of cheers. Heat was rising in waves to his belly, and with it, the choking fumes of diesel smoke. The shaft was just wide enough for a single person crawling on his elbows. Somewhere below him, gathering in the tunnel that connected the ring to the prison's main entrance, were Olsen's men. There was no way to coordinate their arrivals, nor to communicate with the others stationed in the crowd. They would simply have to guess. Peter saw an opening ahead, a metal grate in the floor of the duct. He pressed his face against it, gazing downward. Below the grate he could see the slats of the catwalk, and farther still, another 20 meters, the floor of the ring, wrapped by a trench of burning fuel. The floor was covered in blood. On the balconies, the crowd had taken up its chanting again. Ring, 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 ring. Peter guessed he and the others were positioned over the east end of the room now. They would have to cross the catwalk in full view of the crowd to reach the stairs to the floor below. He glanced back to Hollis, who nodded, and lifted the grate free, pushing it to the side. Then he freed the safety on his pistol and crawled forward so that his feet straddled the vent. Amy, Peter thought, it's nothing good what's down there. Do what you do, or we're all dead. He pushed himself off, dropping feet first through the opening. He fell and fell, long enough to wonder, why am I always falling? The distance to the catwalk was more than he'd expected. Not 2 meters, but 4 or even 5, and he hit the metal with a bone-rattling bang. He rolled. The pistol was gone, squirted from his grasp. And it was as he rolled that he glimpsed, from the corner of his eye, a figure below. Wrists bound, body slack with submission, wearing a sleeveless shirt that Peter recognized. His mind grabbed hold of this image, which was also a memory, of the smell of pyre smoke on the day they'd burned the body of Xander Phillips, standing in the sunshine outside the power station, and the name stitched over the pocket. Armando. Theo. The man in the ring was Theo. His brother wasn't alone. There was someone else beside him, a man on his knees. He was stripped to the waist, slumped forward on the ground so that his face was obscured. And as Peter's vision widened, he realized that what he was seeing on the floor of the ring was the cattle, or what had once been the cattle. They were strewn in pieces everywhere, as if they had been situated at the heart of an explosion, and crouched at the center of this heaping mass of blood and flesh and bone, its face bent to bury itself in the remains, its body twitching with a darting motion as it drank, was a viral. But not like any viral Peter knew. It was the largest he had ever seen, that anyone had ever seen, its curled bulk so immense that it was like some new being entirely. Peter! You're in time to watch the show. He had come to rest on his back, useless as a turtle. Jude, standing above him, wearing a look that Peter had no name for, a dark pleasure beyond words, was aiming a shotgun at his head. Peter felt the shudder of footsteps coming toward them, more orange-suited men racing down the catwalks from every direction. Jude was standing directly below the vent. "Go ahead," Peter said. Jude smiled. "How noble." "Not you," Peter said, and flicked his eyes upward. "Hollis." Jude lifted his face in time for the bullet from Hollis's rifle to strike him just above the right ear, a misty bloom of pink. Peter felt the air dampen with it. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the shotgun released from Jude's hands, clattering to the catwalk. A large butted pistol was tucked at his waist. Peter saw Jude's hand grope for it, blindly searching. Then something released inside him. Blood began to pour from his eyes, a pitiful weeping of blood, and he dropped to his knees, flopping forward, his face frozen in an expression of eternal wonderment, as if to say, "I can't believe I'm dead." It was Mausami who killed the operator manning the fuel pump. She and Amy had entered from the main tunnel just before the crowd arrived and had hidden under the stairs that connected the floor of the courtyard to the balconies. For many minutes they had waited, huddled together, emerging only when they heard the sound of the cattle being driven in, the wild cheers exploding above. The air was broiling, choked with smoke and fumes. There was something terrible behind the flames. As the viral tore into the cattle, the crowd seemed to detonate, everyone pumping their fists, chanting and stomping their feet like a single being caught in some great and terrible ecstasy. Some were holding children on their shoulders so they could see. The cattle were screaming now, bucking and tearing around the ring, racing toward the flames and backing away in confusion, a mad dance between two poles of death. While Mausami watched, the viral sprang forward and snatched one by its hind legs, lifting upward with a deep cracking sound, twisting until the legs came free, then flinging them through the air to slap against the cages in a spray of blood. The creature left that one where it was, its front legs twitching at the dirt, struggling to pull its ruined body forward, and seized another by the horns, applying the same twisting motion to break its neck, then shoved its face into the stilled flesh at the base of the animal's throat, the viral's whole torso seeming to inflate as it drank, the steer's body contracting with each of the viral's muscular inhalations, shriveling before Mausami's eyes as the blood was pulled from its body. She did not see the rest. She'd turned her face away. "Bring them to me," a voice was calling. "Bring me one and then another. Bring them that we should live, in this way and no other." That was when she saw Theo. In that instant, Mausami experienced a collision of joy and terror so violent it was as if she were stepping from her own body. Her breath seized up inside her. She felt dizzy and sick. Two men in jumpsuits were pushing Theo forward, driving him through a gap in the flames. His eyes had an empty, almost bovine look. He seemed to have no idea what was happening around him. He lifted his face to the crowd, blinking vacantly. She tried to call out to him, but her voice was drowned in the foam of voices. She looked for Amy, hoping the girl would know what to do, but couldn't see her anywhere. Above and around her, the voices were chanting again. "Ring, ring, ring." And then the second man was brought in, held at the elbows by two guards. His head was bowed, his feet seemed barely to touch the floor as the men, supporting his weight, dragged him forward and pitched him onto the ground and darted away. The cheers of the crowd were deafening now, a wash of sound. Theo staggered onward, scanning the crowd as if someone there might be bringing help. The second man had brought himself upright on his knees. The second man was Finn Darrell. Suddenly a woman was standing before her, a familiar face with a long pink scar stitched to the cheekbone like a seam. Her jumpsuit bulged with the belly of her pregnancy. "I know you," the woman said. Mousami backed away, but the woman gripped her by the arm, her eyes locking on Mausami's face with a fierce intensity.
I know you. I know you. Let me go.
She pulled away. Behind her, the woman was frantically pointing, shouting,
I know her! I know her!
Mausami ran. All thoughts had left her but one. She had to get to Theo. But there was no way past the flames. The viral was almost done with the cattle. The last lay twitching under its jaws. In another few seconds it would rise and see the two men, see Theo. And that would be the end. Then Mausami saw the pump. A huge, greasy bulk, connected by long trailing hoses to a pair of bulging fuel tanks, weeping with rust. The operator was cradling a shotgun across his chest. A blade hung on his belt in a leather sheath. He was facing away, his eyes, like everyone's, trained on the spectacle unfolding beyond the fluttering wall of flame. She felt a flicker of doubt. She'd never killed a man before. But it was not enough to stop her. In a single motion, she stepped behind the guard and drew the blade and shoved it with all her strength into his lower back. She felt a stiffening, the muscles of his frame drawing tight like a bow. From deep inside his throat came an exhalation of surprise. She felt him die. Punching through the din, a voice from high above. Peters?
Theo! Run!
The pump was a throbbing confusion of levers and knobs. Where were Michael and Caleb when you needed them? Mausami picked the largest one. A wild guess, a lever as long as her forearm, and wrapped it in her fist and pulled.
Stop her! Someone yelled. Stop that woman!
As Mausami felt the shot entering her upper thigh, a strangely trivial pain like the sting of a bee, she realized she'd done it. The flames were dying, guttering around the ring. The crowd was suddenly backing away from the wires, everyone yelling, chaos erupting. The viral had broken away from the last of the cattle, drawing itself erect. All throbbing light and eyes and claws and teeth, its smooth face and long neck and massive chest bibbed in blood. Its body looked swollen, like a tick's. It stood at least 3 meters, maybe more. With a flick of its head, it found Finn with its eyes, head cocking to the side, body tensing as it took aim, preparing to spring, and then it did. It seemed to cross the air between them at the speed of thought, invisible as a bullet was invisible, arriving all at once where Finn lay helpless. What happened next, Mausami did not see clearly and was glad that she did not. It was so fast and terrible, like the cattle, but vastly worse, because it was a man. A splash of blood like something bursting, and part of Finn went one way and part of him another.
Theo.
She thought, as the pain in her leg abruptly deepened, a wave of heat and light that bent her double. The leg folded beneath her, sending her pitching forward.
Theo, I'm here. I've come to save you. We have a baby, Theo. Our baby is a boy.
As she fell, she saw a figure sprinting across the ring. It was Amy. Her hair was pulling a trail of smoke. Darting tongues of fire were licking at her clothing. The viral had shifted his attention toward Theo now. Amy charged between them, protecting Theo like a shield. Faced with the creature's immense, bloated form, she seemed tiny, like a child. And in that instant, which felt suspended, the whole world brought to a halt while the viral regarded the small figure before him. Mausami thought,
that girl wants to say something. That girl is going to open her mouth and speak.
20 meters overhead, Hollis had dropped through the vent with his rifle, followed by Alicia, holding the RPG. She swung it toward the floor, pointing its barrel at the place where Amy and Babcock stood.
I don't have a shot!
Caleb and Sarah dropped through behind them. Peter snatched Jude's shotgun from the floor of the catwalk and fired in the direction of the two men racing down the catwalk toward them. One man uttered a strangled cry and fell away, tumbling headfirst to the floor below.
"Shoot the viral,"
he called to Alicia. Hollis fired and the second man dropped face down onto the catwalk.
"She's too close," Alicia said.
"Amy," Peter yelled, "get out of there."
The girl stood her ground. How long could she hold him that way? And where was Olson? The last of the fires had gone out. People were streaming down the stairs, an avalanche of orange jumpsuits. Theo, on his hands and knees, was backing away from the viral, but his heart was nowhere in this. He had accepted his fate. He had no strength to resist. Caleb and Sarah had made it across the catwalk to the stairs now, descending into the melee on the balconies. Peter heard women screaming, children crying, a voice that sounded like Olson's rising over the din.
"The tunnel! Everyone run to the tunnel!"
Mausami lurched into the ring.
"Over here!"
She stumbled, catching herself with her hands as she fell to the floor. Her pants were soaked in blood. On all fours, she tried to rise. She was waving, screaming.
"Look over here!"
"Mouse," Peter thought. "Keep back." Too late. The spell was broken. The viral rocked its face toward the ceiling and drew down into a crouch, its body gathering energy like a coiled spring. And then it was flying, lofting through the air. It rose toward them with a pitiless inevitability, arcing over their heads and seizing one of the ceiling struts, body rotating like child swinging on a tree limb, an oddly exhilarating, even joyful image, and landed on the catwalk with a shuddering clang. "I am Babcock. We are Babcock."
"Leash!"
Peter felt the RPG sailing past his face, the scald of hot gas on his cheek. He knew what was going to happen before it did. The grenade exploded. A punch of noise and heat, and Peter was shoved backward into Alicia, the two of them tumbling onto the catwalk. But the catwalk wasn't there. The catwalk was falling. Something caught and held, and they banged down hard, and for a hopeful moment everything stopped. But then the structure lurched again, and with a pop of rivets and a groan of bending metal, the end of the catwalk broke away from the ceiling, tilting toward the floor like the head of a hammer, falling. Leon in the alley, face down in the dirt.
"God damn," he thought. "Where did that girl go?"
Some kind of gag was in his mouth. His wrists were bound behind him. He tried to wriggle his feet, but they were tied too. It was the big one, Hollis. Leon remembered now. Hollis had risen out of the shadows, swinging something, and the next thing Leon knew, he was all alone in the dark and couldn't move. His nose was thick with snot and blood. Probably the son of a bitch had broken it. That was all he needed, a broken nose. He thought he'd cracked a couple of teeth, too, but with the gag in his mouth, his tongue stuffed behind it, he had no way to check. It was so goddamn dark out here, he couldn't see 2 feet in front of his face. The reek of garbage was coming from somewhere. People were always putting it in the alleys instead of taking it to the dump. How many times had he heard Jude tell people, "Take your fucking garbage to the dump. What are we, pigs?" A joke, sort of, since they weren't pigs, but what was the difference, really? Jude was always making jokes like that, to watch people squirm. For a while, they'd kept pigs. Babcock liked pork almost as much as he liked the cattle, but some kind of sickness had wiped them out one winter. Or maybe they'd just seen what was coming and decided, "What the hell, I'd rather just lie down and die in the mud." No one would be coming to look for Leon, that was for sure. The problem of standing up was his to solve on his own. He could sort of see a way to do it by drawing his knees to his chest. It made his shoulders hurt something terrible, twisted back like they were, and pushed his face with its broken nose and teeth into the dirt. He gave a yelp of pain through the gag, and by the time he was done with it, he was woozy and breathing hard, the sweat popping out all over. He lifted his face. More pain in his shoulders. What the fuck had that guy done, tying his hands so tight? And raised his upper body until he was sitting up, his knees folded under him, and that was when he realized his mistake. He had no way to stand. He'd sort of thought he could push off with his toes, jumping his way into a standing position. But this would just send him pitching forward onto his face again. He should have scooched over to the wall first, used it to shimmy his way up. But now he was stuck, his legs jammed up under him, frozen in place like a big dumb shit. He tried to call for help. Nothing fancy, just the word hey, but it came out as a strangled ah sound and made him want to cough. Already he could feel the circulation going out of his legs, a prickly numbness crawling up from his toes like ants. Something was moving out there. He was facing the mouth of the alley. Beyond it lay the square, a zone of blackness since the fire barrel had gone out. He peered into the dark. Maybe it was Hap, coming to look for him. Well, whoever it was, he couldn't see a goddamn thing. Probably his mind was playing tricks on him. Alone outside on New Moon, anybody could get a little jumpy. No. Something was moving. Leon felt it again. The feeling was coming from the ground, through his knees. A shadow streaked above him. He lifted his head quickly, finding only stars set in a liquidy blackness. The feeling through his knees was stronger now, a rhythmic shuddering, like the flapping of a thousand wings. What the goddamn? A figure darted into the alley. Hap.
Oh!
He said through the gag.
Oh!
But Hap seemed not to notice him. He paused at the edge of the alley, panting for breath, and raced away. Then he saw what Hap was running from. Leon's bladder released, and then his bowels. But his mind was unable to register these facts as all thought was obliterated by an immense and weightless terror. The end of the catwalk impacted the floor with a massive jolt. Peter, clutching one of the guardrails, barely managed to hold on. An object tumbled past him, clattering end over end before bounding into space. The empty RPG, spiraling a meteoric wick of smoke from its tube. Then something heavy struck him from above, ripping his hand away. Hollis and Alicia tangled together, and that was that. The three of them were falling free, sliding down the angled catwalk to the floor below. They hit the ground in a confusion of arms and legs and bodies and equipment, scattering across the floor like balls tossed from a hand. Peter came to rest on his back, blinking at the distant ceiling, his mind and body roaring with adrenaline. Where was Babcock? Come on! Alicia had grabbed him by the shirt and was pulling him to his feet. Sarah and Caleb were beside her. Hollis was hobbling toward them, somehow still carrying his rifle.
We have to get out of here.
Where did it go?
I don't know. It jumped away.
The remains of the cattle were strewn everywhere. The air stank of blood, of meat. Amy was helping Mouse to her feet. The girl's clothes were still smoking, though she seemed not to notice. A patch of her hair had been scorched away, revealing a raw pinkness of scalp.
Help Theo,
Mausami said, as Peter crouched before her. Mouse, you're shot. Her teeth were clenched with pain. She shoved him away.
Help him!
Peter went to where his brother was kneeling in the dirt. He seemed dazed, his expression disordered. His feet were bare, his clothing was in tatters, his arms were covered with scabs.
What had they done to him?
Theo, look at me, Peter commanded, gripping him by the shoulders. Are you hurt? Do you think you can walk? A small light seemed to go on in his brother's eyes. Not the whole Theo, but at least a glimmer.
Oh my God, said Caleb. That's Finn!
The boy was pointing toward a bloody shape on the floor a few meters away. Peter thought at first it was a piece of the cattle, but then the details came into focus and he understood that this lump of meat and bone was half a person. A torso and head and a single arm, which lay twisted at an odd angle over the dead man's forehead. Below the waist there was nothing. The face, just as Caleb had said, was Finn Darrell's. He tightened his grip on Theo's shoulders. Sarah and Alicia were lifting Mausami to her feet.
Theo, I need you to try to walk.
Theo blinked and licked his lips.
Is it really you?
Brother, Peter nodded. You came for me.
Caleb, Peter said, help me. Peter pulled Theo upright and wrapped an arm around his waist, Caleb taking him from the other side. Together, they ran. They exited into the dark tunnel, into the fleeing crowds. People were tearing toward the exit, pushing and shoving. Up ahead, Olsen was waving people through the opening, screaming at the top of his voice, "Run to the train!" They burst from the tunnel into the yard. Everyone was making for the gate, which stood open. In the darkness and confusion, a bottleneck had formed, too many people trying to shove their way through the narrow opening at once. Some were attempting to scale the fence, hurling themselves against the wires and clawing their way up. As Peter watched, a man at the top fell backward, screaming, one leg tangled in the barbs.
"Caleb!" Alicia cried. "Take Mouse!"
The crowd was surging around them. Peter saw Alicia's head bobbing above the fray, a flash of blonde hair he knew to be Sarah's. The two of them were moving in the wrong direction, fighting the current of the crowd.
"Leash! Where are you going?"
But his voice was overpowered by a blast of sound, a single sustained note that split the air, seeming to come not from one direction but from everywhere at once.
"Michael," he thought.
Michael was coming. They were suddenly propelled forward, the energy of the panicked throng lifting them like a wave. Somehow Peter managed to keep hold of his brother. They passed through the gate and into another mob of people compressed into the gap between the two fence lines. Someone banged into him from behind, and he heard the man grunt and stumble and fall beneath the feet of the crowd. Peter fought his way through, pushing, shoving, using his body like a battering ram, until at last they burst free of the second gate. The tracks were dead ahead. Theo seemed to be rousing, doing more to carry his own weight as they fought their way forward. In the chaos and darkness, Peter couldn't see any of the others. He called their names, but heard no answer over the yelling of the figures tearing past him. The road ascended a sandy rise, and as they neared the top, he saw a glow of light coming from the south. Another blast of the horn, and then he saw it. A huge silver bulk churning toward them, parting the night like a blade. A single beam of light shot from its bow, shining over the masses of figures crowding around the tracks. He saw Caleb and Mausami up ahead, racing toward the front of the train. Still holding Theo, Peter stumbled down the embankment. He heard a squeal of brakes. People were racing alongside the train, trying to grab hold. As the engine drew closer, a hatch opened in the front cab and Michael leaned out.
"We can't stop!"
"What?"
Michael cupped his mouth.
"We have to keep moving!"
The train had slowed to a crawl. Peter saw Caleb and Hollis lifting a woman into one of the three open boxcars trailing the engine. Michael was helping to pull Mausami up the ladder into the cab, Amy pushing from behind. Peter began to run with his brother, trying to match their speed with the ladder. As Amy ducked into the hatch, Theo grabbed hold and began to ascend. When he reached the top, Peter dove for the ladder and pulled himself up, his feet swinging free. Behind him, he heard a sound of gunfire, shots pinging off the sides of the cars. He slammed the door closed behind him to find himself in a cramped compartment, glowing with 100 tiny lights. Michael was sitting at the control panel, Billy beside him. Amy had withdrawn to the floor behind Michael's chair, her eyes wide, her knees protectively pulled to her chest. To Peter's left, a narrow hallway led aft.
"Flyers, Peter," Michael said, swiveling in his chair. "Where the hell did Theo come from?"
Peter's brother was slumped on the floor of the hallway. Mausami was holding his head against her chest, her bloody leg folded under her. Peter directed his voice to the front of the cab.
"Is there a med kit in this thing?"
Billy passed him a metal box. Peter popped it open and withdrew a cloth bandage, rolling it into a compress. He tore the fabric of Mausami's pant leg away to reveal the wound, a crater of torn skin and bloody flesh, and placed the bandage against it and told her to hold it there. Theo lifted his face, his eyes flickering.
"Am I dreaming you?"
Peter shook his head.
"Who is she?"
"The girl."
"I thought..."
His voice trailed away. For the first time, it struck him. He had done it. Take care of your brother.
There'll be time later, okay? Thea managed a weak smile.
Whatever you say.
Peter moved to the front of the cab, between the two seats. Through the slit of windshield between the plates, he could see a view of desert in the beam of the headlamp and the tracks rolling under them.
Is Babcock dead? Billy asked.
He shook his head.
You didn't kill him?
The sight of the woman filled him with a sudden anger.
Where the hell was Olson?
Before she could answer, Michael broke in.
Wait, where are the others? Where's Sarah?
The last Peter had seen her, she was with Alicia at the gate. I think she must be in one of the other cars. Billy had opened the cabin door again, leaning out. She ducked her head back inside.
I hope everybody's on board, she said, because here they come. Hit the gas, Michael. My sister could still be out there, Michael shouted. You said no one gets left.
Billy didn't wait. She reached across Michael, knocking him back into his chair, and gripped a lever on the panel, pushing it forward. Peter felt the train accelerate. A digital readout on the panel sprang to life, the number swiftly rising. 30. 35. 40. Then she shoved her way past Peter into the hallway, where a ladder in the wall led to a second hatch in the ceiling. She briskly ascended, turning the wheel, directing her voice to the rear of the train.
Gus! Up top! Let's go!
Gus jogged forward, dragging a canvas duffel bag, which he unzipped to reveal a pile of short-barreled shotguns. He passed one to Billy and took one for himself, then lifted his grease-stained face to Peter, handing him a weapon.
If you're coming, he said gruffly, you might want to remember to keep your head down.
They ascended the ladder, Billy first, then Gus. As Peter lifted his head through the hatch, a blast of wind smacked him in the face, making him duck. He swallowed, pushing his fear down inside himself, and made a second attempt, easing through the opening with his face turned toward the front of the train, sliding onto the roof on his belly. Michael passed him the shotgun from below. He eased into a crouch, trying to find his footing while simultaneously cradling the shotgun. The wind was slapping him, a continuous pressure threatening to push him over. The roof of the engine was arched, with a flat strip down the middle. He was facing the rear of the train now, giving his weight to the wind. Billy and Gus were already well ahead of him. As Peter watched, they leapt the gap between the first and second boxcars, making their way aft into the roaring dark. He first saw the virals as a region of pulsing green light from the rear. Above the din of the engine and the squeal of the wheels on the rails, he heard Billy yelling something, but her words were yanked away. He drew a breath and held it and leapt the gap to the first boxcar. Part of him was wondering, what am I doing here? What am I doing on the roof of a moving train? While another part accepted this fact, strange as it seemed, as an inevitable consequence of the night's events. The green glow was closer now, breaking apart as it widened into a wedge-shaped mass of bounding points, and Peter understood what he was seeing, that it was not just 10 or 20 virals, but an army of hundreds. The many of Babcock. As the first one took shape, vaulting through the air toward the rear of the train, Billy and Gus fired. Peter was halfway down the first boxcar now. The train shuddered and he felt his feet begin to slide, and just like that, the shotgun was gone, falling away. He heard a scream, and when he looked up, there was no one. The place where Billy and Gus had stood was empty. He had barely found his footing again when a huge crash from the front of the train pitched him forward. The horizon collapsed. The sky was gone. He was sliding on his belly down the sloping roof of the car. Just when it seemed he would sail into space, his hands found a narrow lip of metal at the top of one of the armored plates. There was no time even to be afraid. In the whirling darkness, he sensed the presence of a wall shooting past him. They were in some kind of tunnel, boring through the mountain. He held on fast, feet swinging, scrabbling at the side of the train, and then he felt the air opening beneath him as the door of the boxcar flew open, and hands grabbing him, pulling him down and in.
The hands belonged to Caleb and Hollis. In a heap of arms and legs, they spilled onto the floor of the boxcar. The interior was lit by a single lantern swaying from a hook. The car was nearly empty. Just a few dark figures huddled against the walls, apparently immobilized by fear. Beyond the open door, the walls of a tunnel were flying past, filling the space with sound and wind. As Peter climbed to his feet, a familiar figure emerged from the shadows. Olsen Hand. A furious anger broke inside him. Peter seized the man by the scruff of his jumpsuit, shoving him against the wall of the boxcar and pushing his forearm up against his throat.
Where the hell were you? You left us there!
All color was drained from Olsen's face.
I'm sorry. It was the only way.
All at once he understood. Olsen had sent them into the ring as bait.
You knew who it was, didn't you? You knew it was my brother all along.
Olsen swallowed, the point of his Adam's apple bobbing against Peter's forearm.
Yes. Jude believed others would come. That's why we were waiting for you in Las Vegas.
Another crash detonated from the front of the train. Everyone went spilling forward. Olsen was ripped from Peter's grasp. They were out of the tunnel again, back on open ground. Peter heard gunfire from outside and looked to see the Humvee racing past, Sarah in the driver's seat, her knuckles clenched to the wheel, Alicia up top on the big gun, firing in concentrated bursts toward the rear of the train.
Get out!
Alicia was waving frantically toward the last boxcar.
They're right behind you!
Suddenly all the people in the car were yelling, shoving, trying to scramble away from the open door. Olsen gripped one of the figures by the arm and pushed her forward.
Mira.
Take her,
he yelled.
Get her to the engine. Even if the cars are overrun, it's safe there.
Sarah had drawn alongside, matching her speed to the train's, trying to narrow the space. Alicia was waving to them.
Jump!
Peter leaned out the door.
Bring it closer!
Sarah drew in. The racing vehicles were less than 2 meters apart now, the Humvee positioned below them on the angled rail bed.
Reach out!
Alicia called to Mira.
I'll catch you!
The girl, standing at the edge of the doorway, was rigid with fear.
I can't!
She wailed. Another splintering crash. Peter realized the train was barreling through debris on the tracks. The Humvee swayed away as something large and metal went whirling through the space between the vehicles, just as one of the huddled figures leapt to his feet and made a dash for the door. Before Peter could speak, the man had hurled himself into the widening breach, a desperate plunge. His body slammed into the side of the Humvee, his outstretched hands clawing at the roof. For a moment it seemed possible that he would manage to hold on. But then one of his feet touched the ground, dragging in the dust, and with a wordless cry, he was whisked away.
Hold it steady!
Peter yelled. Twice more the Humvee approached. Each time Mira refused to go.
This won't work, Peter said. We'll have to go over the roof.
He turned to Hollis.
You go first. Olsen and I can push you up.
I'm too heavy. Hightop should go, then you. I'll lift Mira up.
Hollis dropped to a crouch. Caleb climbed aboard his shoulders. The Humvee had swayed away again, Alicia firing in short bursts at the rear of the train. With Hightop on his shoulders, Hollis positioned himself at the edge of the door.
Okay, let's go!
Hollis ducked away, keeping one hand gripped on Caleb's foot. Peter grabbed the other. Together they pushed the boy upward, propelling Caleb over the lip of the door. Peter ascended the same way. From the roof of the car, he could see that the mass of virals, having passed through the tunnel, had broken apart into 3 groups. One directly behind them, 2 following on either side. They were racing in a kind of gallop, using both their hands and their feet to propel themselves forward in long leaps. Alicia was shooting at the head of the central group, which had closed to within 10 meters. Some went down, dead or injured or merely stunned, he couldn't tell. The pod closed over them and kept coming. Behind them, the other 2 groups began to merge, passing through one another like currents of water, separating once again to reform their original shapes. He lay on his belly beside Caleb and reached down as Hollis lifted Mira up. They found the frightened girl's hands and pulled, drawing her onto the roof.
Alicia, below them.
Get down!
Three virals were on the roof of the last boxcar now. A blast of fire erupted from the Humvee and they jumped away. Caleb was already vaulting across the gap to the engine. Peter reached for Mira, but the girl was frozen in place, her body pressed to the roof of the car, her arms hugging it as if it were the one thing that might save her.
Mira,
Peter said, trying to pull her free.
Please!
Still she held on.
I can't, I can't, I can't!
From below, a clawed hand reached up, wrapping around her ankle.
Papa!
Then she was gone. There was nothing else he could do. Peter dashed toward the gap, took it at a leap, and dropped through the hatch behind Caleb. He told Michael to hold the train steady and swung open the door to the cabin and looked aft. The virals were all over the third boxcar now, clinging to the sides like a swarm of insects. So intense was their frenzy that they appeared to be fighting with one another, snapping and snarling for the right to be the first ones inside. Even over the wind, Peter could hear the screams of the terrified souls inside. Where was the Humvee? Then he saw it, racing toward them at an angle, bouncing wildly over the hardpan. Hollis and Olson were clinging to the vehicle's roof. The big gun was depleted, all its ammo spent. The virals would be all over them any second. Peter leaned out the door.
Bring it closer!
Sarah gunned the engine, drawing alongside. Hollis was the first to grab the ladder, then Olson. Peter pulled them through into the cab and called down,
Alicia, you go! What about Sarah?
The Humvee was drifting away again, Sarah fighting to keep them close without colliding. Peter heard a crash as the door of the last boxcar was ripped away, tumbling end over end into the receding darkness.
I'll get her! Just grab the ladder!
Alicia jumped from the roof of the Humvee, hurling her body across the gap. But the distance was suddenly too great. In his mind, Peter saw her falling, her hands grabbing at nothing, her body tumbling into the crushing rush of space between the vehicles. But then she had done it. Her hands had found the ladder. Alicia was climbing, hand over hand, up the train. When her feet reached the bottom rung, she turned, stretching her body into the gap. Sarah was gripping the wheel with one hand. With the other, she was frantically trying to wedge a rifle into place to brace the gas pedal.
It won't stay! Forget it! I'll grab you, Alicia called. Just open the door and take my hand! It won't work!
Suddenly, Sarah gunned the motor. The Humvee shot forward, pulling ahead of the train. Sarah was on the edge of the tracks now. The driver's door swung open. Then she hit the brakes. The edge of the train's plow caught the door and sheared it off like a blade, sending it whirling away. For a breathtaking instant, the Humvee rocked onto its two right wheels, skidding down the embankment, but then the left side of the vehicle banged down. Sarah was moving away now, rocketing across the hard pan at a 45-degree angle to the train. Peter saw a skid in the dust, and then she was pulling alongside again. Alicia stretched a hand out into the gap. Peter.
Leash, whatever you're going to do, do it now!
How Alicia managed it, Peter would never fully comprehend. When he asked her about it later, Alicia only shrugged. It wasn't anything she'd thought about, she told him. She had simply followed her instincts. In fact, there would come a time, not much later, when Peter would learn to expect such things from her. Extraordinary things. Unbelievable things. But that night, in the howling space between the Humvee and the train, what Alicia did seemed simply miraculous, beyond knowing. Nor could any of them have known what Amy, in the engine's aft compartment, was about to do, or what lay between the engine and the first boxcar. Not even Michael knew about that. Perhaps Olson did. Perhaps that was why he'd told Peter to take his daughter to the engine, that she'd be safe there. Or so Peter reasoned in the aftermath. But Olson never said anything about this, and under the circumstances, in the brief time they had left with him, none of them would have the heart to ask. As the first viral launched itself toward the Humvee, Alicia reached out, snatching Sarah's wrist off the steering wheel and pulled. Sarah swung out on Alicia's arm in a wide arc, separating from the vehicle as it swerved away. For a horrible instant her eyes met Peter's as her feet skimmed the ground, the eyes of a woman who was going to die and knew it. But then Alicia pulled again, hard, drawing her upward. Sarah's free hand found the ladder, and the two of them were climbing. Sarah and Alicia were up and rolling into the cab.
Which was when it happened. An ear-splitting boom like thunder. The engine lurched violently forward, free of its weight. Everything in the cab was suddenly airborne.
Peter, standing by the open hatch, was slapped off his feet and hurled backward, his body slamming into the bulkhead. He thought,
Amy.
Where was Amy? And as he tumbled to the floor, he heard a new sound, louder than the first, and he knew what this sound was. A deafening roar and a screech of metal as the cars behind them jumped the rails, jackknifing into the air and careering like an avalanche of iron across the desert floor, everyone inside them dead, dead, dead. They came to a stop at half day. The end of the line, Michael said, powering down. The maps Billy had shown them indicated that the rails petered out at the town of Caliente. They were lucky the train had taken them this far.
How far? Peter asked.
400 kilometers, give or take, said Michael. See that mountain ridge? He was pointing through the slitted windshield. That's Utah. They disembarked. They were in some kind of rail yard with tracks all around, littered with abandoned cars, engines, tankers, flatbeds. The land here was less dry. There was tall grass growing and cottonwoods, and a gentle breeze was blowing, cooling the air. Water was running nearby. They could hear the sound of birds.
I just don't get it, Alicia said, breaking the stillness.
Where did they hope to get to? Peter had slept in the train once it was clear no virals were pursuing them, and awakened at dawn to find himself curled on the floor beside Theo and Mouse. Michael had stayed up through the night, but the ordeal of the last few days had eventually caught up with everyone. As for Olsen, perhaps he'd slept, though Peter doubted it. The man had spoken to no one and was now sitting on the ground outside the engine, staring into space. When Peter had told him about Mira, he hadn't asked for any details. Just nodded and said,
Thank you for letting me know.
Anywhere, Peter answered after a moment. He wasn't sure what he was feeling. The events of the night before, the whole 4 days at the Haven, felt like a feverish dream. I think they just wanted to get anywhere. Amy had stepped away from the group into the field. For a moment they watched her, moving through the wind-blown grass.
Do you think she understands what she did? Alicia asked.
It was Amy who had blown the coupler. The switch was located in the rear of the engine compartment by the head-end unit. Probably it had been connected to a drum of diesel fuel or kerosene, Michael surmised, with some kind of igniter. That would have been enough to do it. A failsafe, in case the cars were overrun. It made sense, Michael said, when you thought about it. Peter supposed it did. But none of them could explain how Amy had known what to do, nor what had led her to actually throw the switch. Her actions seemed, like everything else about her, beyond ordinary understanding. And yet it was because of her, once again, that they were all alive. Peter watched her for a long moment. In the waist-high grass, she appeared almost to float, her hands held out from her sides, grazing the feathered tips. Many days had passed since he'd thought of what had happened in the infirmary, but watching her now as she moved through the grass, he was washed by the memory of that strange night. He wondered what she had told Babcock when she had stood before him. It was as if she were part of two worlds, one that he could see and one that he could not. And it was within this other, hidden world that the meaning of their voyage lay.
A lot of people died last night, Alicia said.
Peter drew a breath. Despite the sun, he felt suddenly cold. He was still watching Amy, but in his mind he saw Mira. The girl's body pressed to the roof of the train, the viral's hand reaching for her, pulling her away. The empty space where she had been, and the sound of her screams as she fell. "I think they'd been dead a long time," he said. "One thing's for sure. We can't stay here. Let's see what we've got." They inventoried their supplies, spreading them out on the ground by the engine. It didn't amount to much. Half a dozen shotguns, a couple of pistols with a few rounds each, one automatic rifle, two spare clips for the rifle plus 25 shells for the shotguns, six blades, 8 gallons of water in jugs plus more in the train's holding tank, a few 100 gallons of diesel fuel but no vehicle to put it in, a couple of plastic tarps, 3 tins of sulfur matches, the med kit, a kerosene lantern, Sarah's journal. She had removed it from her pack when they'd left the hut and stashed it inside her jersey. And no food at all. Hollis said there was probably game out there. They shouldn't waste their ammo, but they could set some snares. Maybe they'd find something edible in Caliente. Theo was sleeping on the floor of the engine compartment. He'd managed to give them a rough accounting of events as best he could recall them. His fragmented memory of the attack at the mall, then his time in the cell and the dream of the woman in her kitchen, and his struggle to stay awake, and the taunting visits of the man whom Peter believed was almost certainly Jude. But the effort of talking was clearly difficult for him, and he'd eventually fallen into a sleep so profound that Sarah had to reassure Peter that his brother was still breathing. The wound to Mausami's leg was worse than she'd claimed, but less than life-threatening. The bullet, or more likely a fragment of shotgun shell, had blasted through her outer thigh, cutting a grisly-looking bloody trench, but exiting cleanly. The night before, Sarah had used a needle and thread from the med kit to sew the wound closed, and had cleaned it with spirits from a bottle they'd found under the sink in the engine's tiny lavatory. It must have hurt like hell, but Mouse had borne all of it with a stoic silence, gritting her teeth as she clutched Theo's hand. As long as she kept it clean, Sarah said, she'd be fine. With luck, she'd even be able to walk in a day or two. The question arose about where to go. It was Hollis who raised it, and Peter found himself taken aback. The thought had never occurred to him that they would fail to press on. Whatever lay ahead of them in Colorado, he felt more strongly than ever that they had to find out what it was, and it seemed far too late to turn back now. But Hollis, he was forced to concede, had a point. Theo and Finn and the woman whom first Alicia and now Mausami claimed was Liza Chow, all had come from the colony. Whatever was happening with